Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Keyshawn, J. Will, and Zubin. You know the guys. Their new show gets simulcasted Monday through Friday, 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio and ESPN News. All hours of the show get podcasted, so be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to Keyshawn, J. Will, and Zubin now, as well as the right time, wherever you get your podcast. Also, Stephen A. Smith goes beyond the headlines to unlock a unique world of hot takes, one-of-a-kind segments, and can't-miss interviews. Stream all this and more on his new show, Stephen A.'s World, exclusively on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to take a look back at the life of Henry Aaron. Also, why I might need to chill out on some of these Detroit Lions jokes. But first, all right, we have gotten to our Super Bowl matchup. I feel like this is the exact one all the people who work in television, if you ask them which one they could get, this is the one that they got. They got the Bucks and the Chiefs. They got Tom Brady and they got Patrick Mahomes. This is the one. They got the old guard and they got the new guard. This is what they would hope to get out of a Super Bowl matchup right here, right? The old heads they've been using to sell the television slate for over a decade, and now the young dude that's supposed to usher it into the future, right? This is where we are. This is what we've got. Now, I've seen some things that people have raised the question of. It's like, is this the best matchup of quarterbacks ever in the Super Bowl? And the answer to that is kind of at best. This is not 2007 Tom Brady that we got out here. Mahomes is the best quarterback in the NFL right now. There's a great chance that Patrick Mahomes may ultimately go down as the greatest quarterback of all time. But this is not Joe Montana and Dan Marino in 1984. This is not Joe Montana and John Elway in 1989. This isn't even John Elway and Brett Favre in 1997. Like, it's not that. And the reason that it's not that is, quite honestly, Tom Brady is not that. Like, we're asking for a lot here, and it's wild. Like, I was watching Get Up this morning, and they were talking about Tom Brady, and they were going through all the, like, historical type of stats, and as this has happened, now we got all the people in the world that's out here trying to make the argument that, well, maybe Tom Brady is the greatest athlete in the history of team sports because the Buccaneers got to this Super Bowl, right? Are you high? Like, if you want to make the argument that Tom Brady is the greatest athlete in team sports because of the success that his teams have had, you can make an argument for it if you want to, right? Like, you can go ahead and try to give that a run. However, did y'all watch the playoffs? I can't be the only person that's watched Tom Brady play in the playoffs this year. Like, did you watch Tom Brady against the Packers? Because guess what? He stunk. Did you watch Tom Brady against the Saints? He kind of stunk there too. It just so happened that the other quarterback that he was playing against was also old as hell. And therefore, he was stinking while Tom Brady was out here stinking, and somebody had to win. And it just so happened to be the Buccaneers that pulled it off. Now, I don't think that Aaron Rodgers stunk in the NFC Championship game. I don't think he was great, but I don't think that he stunk. Tom Brady had a stretch where he threw 3 interceptions in 7 attempts. And yo man Joe Buck be looking for any reason to say it's not Tom Brady's fault. Like, I think about this more and more as you watch more and more games. And these are just kind of the subtle things I don't think that people realize. I'm going to ask this question. Now, I know somebody going to say I'm going too far or whatever, but I think it's a fair question to ask. You let me know if I'm tripping here. If it was black people throwing the passes and white people catching the passes, do you think that we would assume that just because you got your hand on the ball that you're required to catch it? Just get your hand on it. So, like, that one play where a ball was too high for Mike Evans to catch. Mike Evans is 6'5", all right? Ball's too high for Mike Evans to catch. He goes up. He tries to get it. All Joe Buck can say about it is, oh, it went off his hands. It didn't go off his hands. It went off his fingertips. Not the same. It just every time Joe, hey, well, you know, it went off his fingertips. Do you know how fingertips work? Like, fingertips are not the thing that allow you to bring everything back. It's not really how this works, right? But if every time you throw a pass, and if a receiver does something superhuman to even get his hand on it in the first place, then you blame him for it? It infuriates me. And I do wonder if the white man was the one that was expected to go out here and do this, whether or not we would have this same axiom that just as long as you touch the ball, you got to get your hands on it. And you dumbasses, I'm talking about the ones that y'all are listening to this right now. And it's not all of you, because some of you have some common sense, but a lot of you dumbasses that are listening to right now, and you know damn well there's a lot of you are on this kick. Hey man, you know the rule. If you get your hand on it, you have to catch it. Does that make any sense? Hey man, it's the rule. You are a dumbass. Like, I just don't see any other way to talk about you if you are a person who says this other than to say that you are, in fact, a dumbass. Then Tom Brady, you saw the one with the pressure came, and he just threw that thing up there, and Mike Evans was going deep, and the ball came up short, and the Packers wound up making the interception. I actually had people that were saying that he should have known that the heat was coming, so he should have stopped short, as if Tom Brady had any idea where the hell that ball was going. Any whatsoever. All Tom Brady knew was, somebody's coming to hit me. I would prefer not to be hit. Let me heave this. He didn't even take the hit on that play, by the way, if you watch it. And I don't blame him. I ain't trying to get hit. I get it. But y'all just got to acknowledge. Not only was Tom Brady not good in that game, you know who Tom Brady looked like in that game? Jameis. What was it, 3 touchdowns and 3 interceptions? Is that not a Jameis game? Just asking. Right. Jameis got to be at the crib like, I could have done that. Now, could the Buccaneers have won the division? Well, they didn't win the division, but you know, could they have gotten to the playoffs in the way that they got into the playoffs with Jameis quarterback? I don't know. Could they have beaten the Packers with Jameis? Yep, absolutely. Because Tom Brady was out here kicking it like Jameis. No way around it. Defense won that game. Instead, what we gonna do? We gonna get on TV all the time and talk about how it is like, wow, Tom Brady made it happen again. And see, part of what's wild about that to me is we did not do this with Peyton Manning in 2015. Peyton Manning was worse that season than Tom Brady was this season. Like, there's no way around that. Like, Peyton Manning was bad. I think Peyton Manning started 10 games and led the league in interceptions that year. Like, he was not good in that. But we acknowledged that what was going on there is a team was going to ride its defense as far as it could go, and then you just hoped that Manning did not make mistakes, and then they would ultimately get there. That's kind of what's going on this year with the Bucs, or at least in this postseason. That's kind of what's going on here. The defense brought the pain, and they're the ones that got it done in that game against the Packers. But if you're out here expecting Tom Brady to carry the Bucs to the win, I just feel like you haven't been paying very much attention. Like, Tom Brady's been amazing to be 43, but we don't need to come in and give all the look at everything Tom Brady's done in the Super Bowl. Look at all these Super Bowls that Tom Brady's been. We know that. We been know that. The question is, can Tom Brady play well enough where if the Bucs defense does not play well, that he can get them himself to a victory? Can he make that much of a contribution? Because I could be wrong, and Gabe, you let me know if I'm tripping. I feel like it's going to be asking a lot of the defense to carry them to a victory over the Kansas City Chiefs. Can we also talk about people losing their damn minds? Did you see where apparently Matt Hasselbeck got on TV and was doing a tale of the tape of the Chiefs and the Bills, and he said that the Bills had the advantage at quarterback? Did I not tell people that was going to happen? Did I not tell people that was going to happen? That folks just cannot. I've been saying this for weeks and weeks and weeks, right? We've been talking about this. It ain't that many white dudes to ride for playing quarterback these days, right? At the upper echelon of it. I don't understand what y'all got going. But anyway, it's been a bit of a fall off. And then came Josh Allen. And the level of excitement and enthusiasm into making Josh Allen better than he was, we've seen it. I told you I was watching that one game. It was one of those where Romo missed the game for the COVID. And Boomer Esiason was calling the game. And I forget what exactly the context was, but I just remember hearing him use the phrase, the great Josh Allen. Josh Allen was not good against the Ravens. I thought he was pretty good against the Colts, but he was not good against the Ravens. My buddy Nick Wright at Fox, he loves to put up the stats of a line chart of Josh Allen and his quarterback rating from game to game. I mean, it's a bit of an EKG, man. It's an up, down, up, down, up, down sort of scenario. It had all been there, but people so excited and so insistent upon making Josh Allen something that he was not. At his best, he has been great this year. No way around that. We've been through this. We've talked about this many times on this show. At his best, he has been great. You know what he looked like in that game? The Josh Allen that when I talk about it, people get mad, right? The poor decision making, right? trying his hardest to throw the ball away. He had a couple of those where he seemed to throw those Adam balls. The moment was just a little bit big for him. Totally understandable. As young as he is, he hadn't been in a game like this before. That sort of thing was going to happen. I feel like in a lot of ways, the worst thing ever for Josh Allen is the fact that he's so damn strong that he's never just going to take a sack. Like, sometimes you got to do it. Not only is he never just going to take a sack, he ain't even really about that, like, I'm going to just step up in the pocket right fast. Why? Because he's shaking these dudes off, right? And so these dudes get a hold of him. Like, I've been saying this. Don't send no number 21 at no Josh Allen, right? I don't think you need to send no 31 at Josh Allen. Maybe somebody with a number in the 40s. You need to send somebody at him with a number in the 50s or higher. These defensive backs is, like, bouncing off him like he the windshield and they a fly. Like, that's not happening. But those dudes can hold him up long enough. The next thing you know, Josh Allen 15 yards backwards and can't figure out what to do. I think he had a sack he took. That was an 18-yard sack in that game against Kansas City. And that was the longest sack anybody had taken in the postseason since Josh Allen took a 19-yard sack the year before. It was right there. And I just need to understand this. And somebody help me out. Gabe, you let me know. How come ain't no Buffalo fans give no money to charity to say, damn, Bomani, maybe you were right about some of the things that you had to say about him. I'm just saying, go to I Love Josh Allen right now and go ahead and make that. I had warned you that this sort of thing might happen with him. I had told you that these are the issues that come up with him, right? That there are still the ups and downs. Don't nobody want to give no money to charity now? Y'all don't want to help nobody now? Maybe it'll make your sorry asses feel better about the fact that your team lost if you do some good for somebody. What? That's not how you make yourself feel better? That's not, I thought that's what you guys did. Is this thing on? You guys don't want to participate? You guys don't want to help? Anybody? Ain't nobody out here talking about maybe Josh Allen just can't get it done in the postseason? Two straight years that you've seen him have these brain locks? Right? You guys don't want to do it like you do with Lamar and start asking, well, hey, man, I just don't know if he can get it done. You don't want to ask that? Nah, you don't, because everything about Josh Allen is about the benefit of the doubt. Every single thing about it when it comes to him is about the benefit of the doubt. That's just what it comes to. The decision has been made by so many people on so many levels that this is the guy, and we're going to cut him every measure of slack that we possibly can. And I want to say again, in the aggregate, he was really good this year. It's kind of no way around that. I think Buffalo was third in DVOA pass offense this year behind the Chiefs and the Packers. Like, hey, man, dude had a good, strong year. Lamar Jackson had an MVP year last year, and then they lost in the playoffs. And your response is, I don't know if this guy can get it done. Jackson had a great game in the playoffs this year against the Titans. And then they lost that game against the Bills, playing in that crazy wind and everything else, right? I don't know. Just seems like he doesn't play well enough in the playoffs. Paging Josh Allen. You guys want to do that? No, you don't want to do that. You know why you don't want to do that? Because that's ridiculous. Like, I recognize that it's ridiculous. You recognize that it's ridiculous. I recognize that it's unfair. You recognize that it's unfair to put him in that situation, right? But I'm consistent. How about you guys? Where you at? What you got? Anyway, now we're going to get to these playoffs. I mean, this Super Bowl, and we have Patrick Mahomes, and we have Tom Brady. If I had to guess, the Chiefs are going to hammer them. That would be my guess. I just don't think that anybody can stop Kansas City from scoring in the way that you need to do it in order to stop them scoring. I watched them play earlier this year, and the score was closer than the game. That would probably be the best way for me to put it. But Gabe, think about this, man. If Mahomes winds up with back-to-back Super Bowl championships after going to the AFC Championship game his first year as a starter, and there's no reason to think that what they got going is going to slow down. And if they win this, by the way, keep in mind, they'll be winning it basically down four offensive linemen from what they expected to be their starting offensive line going into the season. What do we have that compares to this? Because also understand this. He's a Hall of Famer if they win this one. I don't even think he honestly is going to need to win this one to be a Hall of Famer. This is the reason why I say it. You did not grow up with Dan Marino, right? I did. Dan Marino threw 48 touchdown passes in 1984. Probably the best passing season any quarterback has ever had in the league, right? Threw 48 touchdown passes in 1984. Marino threw 44 touchdown passes in 1986. I don't think he threw 30 touchdowns ever again after that. Like, all the things that get Dan Marino into the Hall of Fame happened before 1986. All of them. That's all it took. That's all it took. So, like, yeah, he put up some more seasons, and you got some all-time records and everything else. But the reputation of Dan Marino was made by 1986. That was really all it took for him to get into the Hall of Fame. Mahomes has done all that, except actually won a Super Bowl. He done it all. If they win this one, dude, he ain't never got to play again. I mean, he will, but he don't ever have to play again. Does not, you know? But hey, man, this should be interesting. Also, Gabe, do we know how many people they're going to let into the Super Bowl? Because it's going to be in Florida, and, you know, Florida ain't really out here, you know, respecting the world right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first time that a home team has hosted the Super Bowl in over 50 years, which is something interesting. But I did see that the NFL was trying to host X number of 1,000 nurses and doctors and such to kind of thank them for their service. And I couldn't help but thinking, like, do we need to add more people to the overall attendance number?
Yeah, I personally don't feel like the way to say thank you to these people is to give them a chance to endanger their lives. Could be wrong. Also, this whole thing about the home stadium is so overstated to me. And people get mad at me about this. I said it on Twitter. I'm like, this home stadium thing is very careful phrasing, because we have had teams play in their home markets during the Super Bowl. So that Montana Marino Super Bowl in January 1985 that we talked about a little bit earlier, the reason that they played it at Stanford Stadium and not at Candlestick Park is because at the time Stanford Stadium had more seats and Candlestick Park is a dump, right? So they had it there. We've had a Rose Bowl where the Rams got into the Super Bowl against the Steelers, played it in the Rose Bowl. I think part of it is that the Rose Bowl had more seats than the Coliseum. The other part is the Rose Bowl is in a nicer neighborhood.
Yeah, tailgates kind of hit different on a putting green than they do in a parking lot.
Yeah, they like to get that sunset that the Rose Bowl, you know, gets for the bowl game and all of that stuff. That's what they want to do. So I said on Twitter, I was just like, they're being very careful in this phrasing, all right? And everybody's like, and I was like, it's close, right? Like, I get why they're being so particular, but it's really not that special or rare. Well, it is pretty special and rare, but you get where I'm coming from. The idea that the game is being played in your city. That, to me, is the part. Like, the home stadium part is, like, seems to be greatly overstated. People are like, yeah, but it's not the home stadium. You don't say, dumbass. You don't say. I just said, you know, they're being very particular in their phrasing, da-da-da. Yeah, because it's not the home stadium. Nobody cares about the Bucks playing in their home stadium. Like, maybe if it was like the Packers playing in Lambeau Field. Obviously, they never do that. But you understand what I'm saying here.
But you know what is special, though? Getting your ass whooped in your own house.
Yes, it is. Well, at least you won't have to have that long flight.
Getting your ass whooped by Patrick Mahomes in the Super Bowl, be home before 5 o'clock.
That's a good point. Like, look, man, my car waiting outside.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, so in 2015, the Miami Dolphins fired their head coach, Joe Philbin, and they replaced him with an interim coach named Dan Campbell. And my buddy Dan, who I used to work with, I ain't never seen anybody offend his sensibilities in this world simply by existing like Dan Campbell did. Or as Dan called him, Man Campbell, right? Because it was all just super high testosterone. We're going to be manly men, win at football type of stuff that he was out here doing. That offended Dan's sensibilities just so terribly much. But the thing was, the dude just seemed like a caricature of a football coach. And by the way, a caricature of a football coach at a time where the caricature of a football coach seemed to be moving away from that. Like the image of the football coach, it didn't. He seemed to be a throwback, but in a way that was not necessarily charming. But that seemed to be him and his get down. And then he went and coached the Saints for a while, and I didn't pay no attention to him when he was coaching the Saints. And he got the job coaching the Detroit Lions, okay? First of all, they gave the man a six-year contract. A man that nobody else was trying to hire. They gave him a six-year contract. And so, of course, this brought out the GTBW observation for a lot of us, right? Nobody even wanted to hire this guy, but you got to make sure that you get him for 6 years. Okay, I guess. Dude's never been a coordinator. He's been an assistant head coach and the tight ends coach. You know, and of course, everybody keeps throwing like, well, what about Eric Bieniemy? What about Eric Bieniemy? And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. You guys will notice I don't throw Bieniemy's name out there that much simply because we're all saying the same name. The issue is not simply that Eric Bieniemy does not get a job, because there may be a reason Eric Bieniemy doesn't get these jobs. I have no idea personally. But you get locked into the what about on this one guy, that misses the point. The point is, like, partially it is, wow, not even this one guy as a black dude could wind up getting a job. But the issue is just, the fact that you only know one name also speaks to what it is that we are talking about as being the problem, right? But again, this became one of those situations where people felt inclined to do that. I personally, like, I want better for Eric Bieniemy. You know what I'm saying? Like, why would I want Eric Bieniemy to go to Detroit? Like, you say you down for the brother. Y'all want to send him out there to Detroit? Come on now. Same thing I felt about the Falcons. Like, if you say y'all love him, you don't want him coaching no damn Falcons. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, Dan Campbell got this job, and then he went and did a press conference, and he looked to be, like, kind of poorly dressed, right? Like, I ain't like his shirt, tie, jacket combination. He ain't look like a professional to me, would be the best way to put it. And then they started asking him about the mentality of the football team, and y'all have seen it by now. He's talking about biting people's kneecaps and getting knocked down and getting back up and knocked down and getting back up and everything else and so forth and so on. And we all out on Dan Campbell. Again, Dan Campbell, six-year contract to be this guy, right? Everybody had the jokes. Everybody had everything. Have you paid much attention to what Dan Campbell has done since then? Do you know who Dan Campbell has hired as his offensive coordinator? Anthony Lynn. Did you see who Dan Campbell hired as his defensive coordinator? Aaron Glenn, former defensive back in the NFL. He played corner. Did you see Deuce Staley, who was a man that people had talked about maybe potentially being a head coach? I don't know how many people have said that, but people have brought it up. And he was coaching with the Eagles and the Lions as a running back coach. And the Lions brought him in as an assistant head coach. All these jokes I had for Dan Campbell, little did I know he was out here on the Bruce Arians kick, hiring all the black dudes and giving them jobs that nobody else will. What the hell am I going to do now? Do we have to root for him? And I feel like we're kind of required to root for him, because if they don't do well in this first year, you know who they're going to blame it all on? The answer, not Dan Campbell. All right, guys, we need some success out of these Detroit Lions. Because apparently, little did we know, all this time we talked about this, like, yo, so there's got to be some coach that cares, right? There's got to be some coach, because the owners are not going to care anything about improving diversity in the ranks of coaching. And the story always was, well, we can't find any to be the head coach because they don't get to be coordinators and call plays and so forth and so on and all of this. And look at Dan Campbell. He's going to have a black dude calling the offensive plays. He's going to have a black dude calling the defensive plays.
But this is quite different, though, than the Bruce Arians thing. Because with Bruce Arians, he's the one with the experience. He's the one with the kind of reputation as, like, the head coach, been there for a long time. If something goes wrong, he can take the heat. If something goes well, he can say, oh, but look at my coaching staff, right? So there's kind of, he can protect them in that way and also allow them to shine. Whereas with Dan Campbell, he doesn't have the experience because he hasn't been a head
that's
coach
fair.
For that long.
That's fair.
Before.
That's fair. That's fine. But damn it, he tried. You can't, like, there's no avoiding that part. Damn it, he tried. You know, like, I don't know who else was on his list. I don't know how it is that he came up and decided that these were the guys that he was going to have a team. I am very curious as to what kind of music Dan Campbell listens to. Like, all of this. Even with Aaron Glenn, where Campbell went to Texas A&M and so did Aaron Glenn, but they didn't play together at A&M. Like, they weren't teammates. So, like, Bruce Arians, for example, part of why Bruce Arians has Byron Leftwich is he coached Byron Leftwich. He coached Todd Bowles. I believe he coached Todd Bowles at Temple. Like, those are guys that he coached that he's brought on for these gigs. That's not even really what's going on here with Dan Campbell. That's like, I'm just saying, like, all the jokes that there are to have about this dude, and I had all the jokes about this dude, we got to give him props for this. Because it's a whole league full of dudes who ain't doing this. In fact, have you looked at that staff that they're putting together in Philadelphia?
If you've seen some of the pictures, it almost comes across as a joke.
Yeah.
They just recasted The Office.
Yo, you want to, that's really funny, because that is really what it looks like. But like, you want to talk about the good to be white scenario. What's the guy's name? Serrani? I had never heard of this dude. Now, that doesn't mean that he shouldn't be a head coach, but I can just say that I had never heard of the dude. He was Frank Reich's offensive coordinator with the Colts, and it seems pretty obvious to me that they're just trying to do somebody they think can make this Carson Wentz thing happen, right? They're just not going to give up on it because they got too much money invested in it. All right, cool. So this dude apparently was on vacation. Did not have a suit to wear to his interview. And he must have let them know that he was not going to be able to wear a suit because he was coming in off of vacation to do this interview. Okay? So what did the Eagles brass do? Everybody showed up in casual clothes so that he would feel more comfortable. Like, I don't know about you, but he should have known right there. He didn't even need to give them no goddamn interview at that point. They wanted him to be the coach. You know how shook my black ass would be if I didn't have a suit to go make that interview work? And I called them up and was like, yo, I just want to let you guys know I wasn't able to get a suit. They'd be like, cool, the mall's open. Like, I'd be out there in a suit that didn't fit. Hey, they would drive me by a restaurant, one of the restaurants with a dress code where you got to have a coat. And so they always got a coat laying around over there. So anyway, they went and hired this dude. He's younger than me, right? Like, he's in his early 30s, all this. And again, maybe he's going to be a very, very good coach. I don't want to hold it against him, the fact that I had never heard of him. I do, however, feel like if this was a dude that really thought anybody wanted him to be a head coach, he wouldn't have been on vacation this week. Or if he had, he would have gone on vacation and he would have took a suit. And so they hired this dude, and I looked at pictures, like Gabe said, of the people that he's hiring. It is wall-to-wall white dudes. Wall-to-wall white dudes. Goodell got to just be like, are you serious? You know, because they're like, okay, y'all do it. Because I've noticed, we've seen of the seven GMs that got hired, and this is the thing, as much as I want to get on the NFL about their head coaching hiring thing, and it's fair because it doesn't seem like there's going to be anybody that gets hired except for maybe in Houston, and I hope that Leslie Frazier is like, no, I'm better than this. But anyway, three of the seven general managers that have been hired were black, and it would have been four probably if the Texans hadn't run their shenanigans, you know, over there with what went down there. That has happened. I am looking up and I'm seeing more black coordinators. The guy that replacing this dude that was going to the Eagles, the guy that's replacing him in Indianapolis is, his name is Marcus Brady. I ain't seen no picture of him, but I feel pretty confident saying that that's a black dude. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I mean, I feel like even if he's not black, hiring a dude named Marcus is progress. But no, if you go look around, we are seeing some movement on the coordinator front. At this point, like, there are things. Oh, he is black. There we go. Like, there are some things that are happening. And I do think that it's fair to mention that Sean McVay hired Raheem Morris to be his defensive coordinator. You know, like, things are going on that are better than they had been on some different fronts. It doesn't make the head coaching thing appropriate, but these things are, in fact, happening. And I do think that we need to point them out as they happen. And as they're happening, the Eagles are just like, nope. There's got to be another white dude we can bring in here somewhere, right? Got to be. Gotta be. That's where we wound up. So, hey, man, shout out to Dan Campbell. Gotta do it, right? No matter what a clown you thought he looked like and everything else, gotta do it. Shout out to him. Because he's putting in a kind of work that very few people in the NFL have ever been willing to do. And so now, please don't embarrass us, right? Yeah, us. I'm talking about us, the black people, us. Don't embarrass us. And there's no way that you can embarrass yourself without embarrassing us. Friday morning, the word got around that Henry Aaron had died in his sleep. And I would like to tell you guys about the two times that I did not meet Henry Aaron. Did not. Okay. The first time I did not meet Henry Aaron was, I believe the year was 1984. And I was with my father at the bank. And this is like my earliest American memory. Like my earliest memories, I think I may have told you guys this, but we lived in Nigeria for a year when I was very, very young. And so like when I was 3 years old. So my earliest memories are in Nigeria. Not a lot of them, but I remember things from Nigeria. I don't remember anything before we went to Nigeria. But the earliest thing that I remember upon our return from Nigeria was me and my dad are at the bank. And my dad says, "Hey, man, that's Hank Aaron." But he didn't realize that we had not gotten far enough in my journey to know what that meant. That's Hank Aaron. Okay, good to know. But I had no idea, right? I wasn't able to be excited or anything like that because I didn't know who Hank Aaron was. So that's the first time I did not meet Hank Aaron. The second time I didn't meet Hank Aaron, I was hosting a radio show on Sirius called The Morning Jones. And my producer, Corey Erdman, one of my favorite people in the world, he had lined up an interview with Hank Aaron. And I'm at my house because I got the ISDN line at the house. And we're set up. And we get Hank Aaron on. And Hank Aaron had 10 minutes. They told us that he had 10 minutes. And we had 10 minutes. And the connection was awful. I couldn't hear a word he said. Not a single thing he said. I could not hear it. Just didn't happen, you know? And I think about that in the context of, like, my dad, and it's something that I didn't really appreciate at the time when it happened, but one of my dad's heroes was the first president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere. And Nyerere had done a speech in Atlanta, and again, 1997, keep this in mind. And so my dad had taken a bunch of pictures, and he went to the Kmart at Greenbrier Mall to pick up his pictures. And they lost him. They lost him. They just didn't have the pictures. They lost him. And I remember, and my dad's one of those people that you don't ever really see lose or frustrated. I just remember the frustration that he had. Because he was just like, "This is one of the most important days of my life. And you lost the pictures." You know? And after Aaron died, that was kind of where I was, like, thinking about that interview that we just couldn't make work. Like, I was so nervous and I was so excited about doing it because it's Henry Aaron, man, you know? And it wasn't going to happen again. But I didn't feel like, I thought maybe it might happen again. You know, there's a chance, you know, and especially as I've gotten farther in this game or whatever. And it never happened again. It never came through. Like, that was kind of one of my thoughts, is that I wanted to start talking about Aaron in the context of the two times that I did not meet Henry Aaron. And the couple days after he died, I watched the coverage and I was like, wow, we are not good at this. And what I meant by not good at this is everything I saw somebody say about Henry Aaron was in the context of this dignity, right? Like, what a great and dignified man that he was. Well, the question is, how do you know that he was so dignified? And the answer is obvious. You know that he was so dignified because of the way that he stood in the face of racism. Not just the racism that came specifically around as he was getting closer to Babe Ruth, but just the racism that he dealt with in his life at every turn, you know? And so what we do with guys like that is we hype up their dignity. And we just talk about how impressed we are at the dignity that that man demonstrated. Because, see, it's interesting. We give Hank Aaron the props for the dignity that he demonstrated, but we give very little empathy to those who did not possess that level of dignity and found themselves shaken and broken by the racism. The people who couldn't just handle it in a level tone. The people who did scream back. The people who did feel the need to fight after that. We talk about them like, at best, like they're complex or whatever it is. But rather than empathize with those people, we hold up somebody like Henry Aaron, and then we say that that guy had so much dignity. The truth is, America had none. Yeah, Aaron had a lot of dignity, but the reason why we're here and the reason that this is tested is because America had no dignity. And so rather than to properly chastise people for the way that they treated Henry, we have to make Henry Aaron into some kind of superhero that in a lot of ways embodies things that honestly, it's unfair to expect anybody to be able to be. It's unfair to expect anybody to live up to the standard or to be able to do the things that Aaron did, right? Like I think about that clip where they show when Aaron hit 715 on April 8th, 1974, and he's coming around the bases and these two college students come around and run around the bases with him. I hate those two guys. I can't stand them. Like, do you realize how far your head had to be up your own ass? Knowing the danger that Aaron was under, knowing the threats and everything that we talk about, can you imagine how scared you would have been when you saw these guys run onto the field, running around with you? Like, I hate those dudes. I would have shit a brick. You know, there would have been no way around it when that happened. But, you know, but like all these things that we watch and that we see that surround Aaron in this, and it's all about, man, that dude had to do that in spite of a spectacular level of racism. But the level of racism that he had to do that in spite of wasn't even really that spectacular. It was actually pretty normal for the day. It was actually pretty normal for the time. There was nothing unreasonable about the expectation that a black man would be coming close to Babe Ruth and that the response was what it was, you know? And so Aaron then became something else because Aaron was doing this in Atlanta, okay? And you got to remember this about Atlanta. The Braves didn't get to Atlanta until 1966. They got to Atlanta after the Civil Rights Act, after the Voting Rights Act. Still Atlanta, right? But it was after some significant things had taken place. And so Aaron then became the face of this new South, right? And Atlanta was selling this image that it was the city that was too busy to hate and all of this stuff. And so what happens around Aaron, and look at the crowd when he hit 715 and everything else, that is Atlanta showing the world how far it's come. You know, as they cheer the black hero in this time. Like, that's what it was. Ignoring the fact of how long it took you to get to the point of even being willing to use Henry Aaron in this way. You know, Henry Aaron lives over off of Adams Drive. I can't remember if it's Adams Drive or Adams Road, but over in Southwest Atlanta, not too far away from the house that my brother and sister grew up in, not too far away from where my parents live right now. Fun fact, Gabe, you may not know this. I believe you may be familiar with the phrase, the dungeon, like the Dungeon family, Outkast, Goody Mob, all of them. The dungeon is where Rico Wade lived, and that was like the pre-production studio in the early days of what they do, the dungeon. The dungeon is across the street from Hank Aaron's house. Like, that's a fun fact for people who do not know. The dungeon's right over there by where Hank lived. But Hank moved in that house. I forget what year he moved into that house. But that was a white neighborhood into the 1960s. And then one black person moved in, and then it was a black neighborhood. Like, the white folks jetted. That's the city that we're talking about. They don't get no credit for cheering for Hank Aaron. They don't get no credit for that at all, right? But that's what people want to do. They want to prop up his dignity and then look at, like, 1974 and talk about their progress and how a guy like him and his dignity could allow white people to make this progress and to get to the places where they are. And I feel like we're missing the point a great deal. One thing that's happened also with Aaron is Milwaukee has been erased. Aaron did not want to come back to Atlanta after starting his career in Milwaukee because he's like, I can go wherever I want in Milwaukee. Like, he had worked to get away from the South. He did not want to come back. It ultimately worked out okay, you know, when he did. But I want to send a shout out to those folks in Milwaukee because Hank Aaron could not have been Hank Aaron in Atlanta. It had to be in a place like Milwaukee. Like, when they first had interleague play in 1997, it was a big deal of the Braves and specifically Henry going back to Milwaukee because he is more a Milwaukee Brave as a baseball player than he was an Atlanta Brave. But everything comes together in Atlanta. There's so many different things. Like, it all swirls, and then you get there, and that's how you wind up with the Aaron that we see in our minds when we talk about him. But just think about, he said it really took him decades to enjoy breaking the home run record. Now, and also, I want to be fair, that Babe Ruth stuff is weird because Roger Maris was losing his hair chasing at, you know, trying to get to 61. And that was a good old-fashioned white man, right? Like, he was going through everything and just the way that people had elevated Babe Ruth, you know? So there's some elements to this that weren't about race. Some of it was just about Babe Ruth. Now, obviously, it was very heavily about race when it came to Aaron, because that's how people do. But just the idea of chasing Ruth meant something in a different way. I remember when Mark McGwire hit 62 in 1998. And he was so happy and he was so excited that he missed first base. He missed it. Like, he had to go back and get to first base. And I remember that they already had a banner. I forget if it was a banner, but they already had something ready to come down when he hit his 62nd home run to commemorate it at Busch Stadium. And everybody was so happy. And Sammy Sosa, it was interesting because Sammy Sosa was there. They were playing against the Cubs that day. And so he and Sammy Sosa came out there. And I just remember, like, how joyous it was for McGwire when he broke it. They asked Aaron after he hit 715, and he was just like, I'm just glad that it's over. There was no joy to be had. And I got Howard Bryant, who wrote a book on Aaron called The Last Hero. He talked about that one of the things that he was happy for Aaron about is that he lived long enough to enjoy the fact that he broke the record. Like, it took a long time, but this racism robbed him of the real-time enjoyment of breaking the single most significant record in American sports. There will never be a record that matters more than 714 was at that time. There never will. And the dude did not even get to enjoy it because people threatened to kidnap his daughter. This is not about his dignity. This should be about his athletic greatness, right? But focusing this around his dignity is to avoid accountability for the people that created a world that would make anybody believe that this was ever an appropriate way to behave. And so that's not to say that Aaron did not possess his dignity as you talk about it. I'm just saying white folks get way too excited to give black people credit for how well they dealt with the racism. Because y'all take that racism as just a given. Like, this is just what it's going to be. That's how y'all treat this racism. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's kind of how I treat this racism. It's okay for me to do that. It's not okay for you to do it. Yeah, we not the same when it comes to this. You know? So, give Henry Aaron all the credit in the world that you possibly can for the life that he lived. I do want to mention something that's a little bit kind of funnier about Aaron, and my Atlanta folks will appreciate this. Black Godfather on Netflix, the documentary about Clarence Avant. It's a really, really good film, and it has the most incredible guest list of any documentary that I have ever seen. Clarence Avant's just one of these guys that's just everywhere. It's kind of hard to explain who he is or what he is, but I'm just telling you, on my recommendation, go watch Black Godfather. But there's a scene in there, and I will not ruin it for the people who have not watched this. Aaron had no endorsement opportunities as he was approaching 715. None. Clarence Avant got down there, got him down with Coca-Cola. He did not have any endorsement opportunities that were lined up to him getting ready to break Babe Ruth's home run record. But anyway, it's almost wild to think about that at this point because Aaron was on top of his money and a well-known businessman in Atlanta after that happened. And let me tell you how about his money Henry was. Henry, you want to talk about a man with a diversified portfolio?
at the same time, Henry Aaron owned a string of car dealerships, including the BMW dealership. And he also owned a string of Church's Fried Chicken locations. Gabe, I don't know if they had Church's Fried Chicken in the Napa Valley when you were growing up, but I'm here to tell you, they are not selling that chicken to the same people who are buying BMWs.
Yeah, the Church's Chicken that is as close to Napa as can be is on the line between Vallejo, California, yes, and Napa American Canyon, literally on the corner.
So you get it. You get where I'm coming from. Henry's like, I'm getting all this money I can, baby. Look, if he had no money till right before, he wasn't getting no money off the home run record till right before. He has a lost time to make up for. But yeah, Henry was slanging them big old Church's Chicken, the Church's Chicken thighs that are the size of like three softballs. He was selling those and he was selling the BMWs, man. He was doing both. So hopefully you got something out of that. I want to try to give you guys some layers to understanding Henry, some layers to understanding Atlanta, layers to understanding ourselves, and the opportunity to laugh at something that always makes me laugh, which is Church's Fried Chicken.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, today's If You Haven't Heard, difference-making stories are brought to you by CarMax. Don't just buy a car. Love your car with the new CarMax Love Your Car Guarantee.
All right, this first story comes from Health.
I'm Hannah Smothers, and I'm a senior staff writer at Vice. I recently asked a handful of doctors about how some of the coping mechanisms and side effects people have developed during the pandemic, like drinking three glasses of wine a night, sleeping badly, and working from our bedrooms, are affecting our general health. What I wanted to know was, will a year of high stress and pretty bad laziness take years off of our lives? Can't be the only one who's worried about this. What the doctors basically told me was that we can pretty much recover from whatever hell we've put our bodies through this past year. For example, a psychologist at NYU told me that the return to offices will be smooth because after a year of remote work, we'll find ourselves craving the boundaries of a commute and having a designated workspace again. We can also expect for everyone to feel slightly awkward about small talk at first, since we've missed out on it for months. But since humans are naturally social, we'll eventually return to normal. And if you're concerned about your lack of exercise or all the junk you've eaten since last March, Leah Wigman, a professor at UT Health, told me we can essentially bounce back by moving more and eating healthier in the future. She put it like this: the past is in the past. Everything is always about what you can do moving forward.
Guys, I'm telling you, I've been telling you this for months now. Get on this yoga, man. Get on this yoga. Man, I had a very long and stressful week last week, so I wasn't really like on it like I've been. Like, I've been working out 5 days a week. I've been doing yoga 3-4 days a week. I did my workouts, but I ain't like, you know, I ain't hit them like I had been hitting them before, and I missed a couple days of yoga. Oh my God, I cannot believe I did that. No, never again. I can tell this yoga will help you, because I know it's getting, like, none of us thought that we'd still be here now. Get you on some yoga, man. Just get the app, get on the video, whatever it takes, roll you out of mat. Get you on this yoga. It will make you feel a whole lot better. And I know this because when I wasn't doing that yoga, I was feeling a whole lot worse.
All right, this next story comes from Business.
Hi, I'm Zoe Schiffer. I'm a writer at The Verge. Last week, Instacart announced it was laying off roughly 2,000 employees as the company doubles down on curbside pickups and phases out in-store shopping at some retail locations. Among those being laid off were 10 employees at a Mariano's grocery store in Skokie, Illinois, who had voted to unionize last year. Now, 10 employees might not sound like a lot, but this union was a really big deal for gig workers in the United States. It was one of the first times employees at a gig platform company had succeeded in forming a union to fight for fair wages and benefits in the U.S. Instacart had tried to stop this from happening. The company distributed anti-union literature and tried to convince employees to vote against the effort, but it didn't work. After it was successful, the union sparked similar organizing efforts among Instacart employees across the country. Now, there could be a chilling effect due to the firings, which hit every current employee who voted to unionize amid those larger layoffs.
Yo, that is just so wild to me that they would be that bold about it.
Do people care enough to have there be pushback?
That is a good question. I think it's less to me about whether people care enough as to whether enough people know. You know, that this happened. Because one thing I saw, I read a story about a week and a half ago,
where, like, with these new variants and new strains that are coming out, that the grocery store might be something that, like, I have gone to the grocery store. That might have to get canceled, right? That being in a grocery store for 20, 30 minutes or whatever it is might prove to be prohibitively dangerous as things are getting more and more contagious. And that would then require me to, like, go to the Instacart route or something like that. But I can't do that for no company that's behaving as such. There's just no way in the world. And one thing we've talked about before is that this country has done an amazing job the last 50 or 60 years just making everybody hate unions. Like, all the good things that unions have done for working people in this country, and the union is treated as the enemy. Always has been. And so it becomes easy to do this. And if you want to know why it is that the union can be treated like the enemy, or like where that all comes down to, there is a movie coming out in February that you might want to check out called Judas and the Black Messiah about Fred Hampton. And I think everything, if you don't understand the hostility toward unions, because I think that some of y'all are young enough that unions haven't even really been a thought, you'll understand where the basis of that distaste comes from after you watch that Fred Hampton movie, which I have not seen, to be clear. I just know enough about the story to know what's going on here. But just the idea, anybody that tried to start a union, we're going, like, that is the kind of stuff that they were doing 100 years ago. Like, that is bananas. People won presidencies in large part by saying that they were going to be on the side of the working man against stuff like that. There is nobody of any real political consequence in this country at this point who stands on the side of the working man. Nobody. And woman. Sorry. Forgive me. But nobody is really, like, kicking it like that and making anything happen. And what's happening as a result? The people that are asking folks to go into the grocery store so people like me can be safe not going into the grocery store, they try to form a union and they all get fired.
All right, this last story comes from tech.
This is Amanda Drain. I'm a business reporter at the Houston Chronicle in Houston, Texas. So I wrote a story about Katrina Parrott, a Black woman from League City, Texas. She claims that Apple stole her racially diverse emoji designs. She filed a copyright infringement lawsuit against Apple in September. So back in 2013, she says she got the idea for the world's first racially diverse emojis. She was talking to her daughter, and her daughter said that she wished that there were emojis that looked like her. So Katrina Parrott had worked at NASA. She was experienced at building teams. So she said she got right to work, hired an illustrator, designer, and within months, she had racially diverse emojis in an app on the Apple App Store. She also joined the Unicode Consortium, a Silicon Valley nonprofit that focuses on software standards, so she could get the word out about diversity and inclusion. She wanted to get in boardrooms with big tech. And sure enough, she said Apple took an interest. That's how she met Apple. And after some back and forth, she said she gave Apple a thumb drive with her emojis, and they had started to talk about implementation in 2014, but then Apple backtracked and said, no, we're going to have our own designers do this. And she said that that sets a bad precedent, that a company can take the proprietary works of smaller companies rather than work with them directly and honor the investment that they've made.
I think she has a point, okay? I want to be very clear. I think that she has a point. However, Gabe, help me out here. How hard is it to be like, okay, so we're going to take this emoji, but make it in different colors? Am I missing something here?
No, same thought crossed my mind.
Yeah, she has a point, right? But where Apple was like, nah, we're going to stick to our own design. What's so bananas about this, and this is no shade to this woman, what's so bananas about this is somebody had to even think of this. That somebody had to be like, yo, you know what would be dope? If there were black and brown emojis too. And somebody was like, wow, never thought of that before. Huh. Ain't that something? She need to try, right? I just think it's so insane that Apple had to be like, guys, I think we need to take a meeting with these people. They say that we can get emojis that look like other people too. The thing about the emojis to me where I find it to be interesting is that big tech is like racially and ethnically diverse. Perhaps not all the way across the board and they don't pick up everybody, but there are definitely people of different colors. Right? So our South Asian brothers and sisters, our East Asian brothers and sisters, white folks, like, it's enough of them there for somebody to think, man, maybe we should have this in different. Nope. Nobody thought of that. Nobody thought of that. Like, I just love the idea that somebody was walking down the hall of the Apple after that meeting and was like, man, that's putting on your thinking cap right there.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. Voicemail segment today. Interesting topic. Tell us how you arrived at it.
Something that didn't actually make any sense. I was thinking about James Harden going to the Nets. And I was like, okay, so somebody wants their homeboy to come in here and go, right? But what happens when you ask your homeboy to show up and he doesn't like he embarrasses you in front of all these people? When in reality, with the Nets, it was Kyrie Irving that got there first, and he's the one that everybody's afraid of embarrassing them. But anyway, so I was like, yo, what about that time you got your homeboy job at your job, and then you wish you had not?
And it generated some interesting responses. Our first comes from Joel in Missouri City.
So this story I'm about to say is about almost 20 years ago. A friend of mine from college, who I sort of lost touch with, you know, because we didn't have social media like that back then. This wasn't even like the MySpace era. So anyway, this friend, he recently lost a job back east and reached out to see if I could help him get a job at this media company that I worked at. And I'm thinking, you know, shoot, of course, I'm going to help my boy out. Should try to put him on if I can. So I helped him get an entry-level job where I worked, which mostly involved answering phones, taking lunch orders, and pitching in when asked. And it became clear that he gradually came to feel that this work was beneath him. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's a dude who had a lot of privilege. He grew up in the OC part of Orange County, but he didn't have a lot of talent, but he still thought that this work was something he should be doing. So anyway, he would like snap at people and just kind of be rude. And, you know, people were kind of afraid of him. And I remember one night, you know, we were in the office talking and he just like dropped this homophobic slur like out of nowhere. And we're like, bro, what's your problem, man? What's going on with you? So needless to say, you know, almost no one in the office liked him, and it became clear that he wasn't going to make it past the 3 month probationary period. So one day I come into work near the end of that time, and I sit across from him, and I see him there, and he's just typing away, like already mad. Nothing has happened. He's mad. And so a few minutes later, a big news story breaks, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was some big news story, and my sports editor yells out across the newsroom at him to help with something. And my boy yells back at him. He's like, hey, don't talk to me like that. I'll f*** you up, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, all of a sudden, you know, the newsroom goes quiet and everybody's just stunned because nobody talks like that in the newsroom. And so while that's happening, I'm like, under my breath, I'm like, hey, bro, maybe you should go for a walk and come back later, you know, when you cool off or whatever. He's muttering under his breath, I'm not letting him talk to me like that. F him. You know what I'm saying? I'm grown. You don't talk to me like that. So anyway, he gets up like he's going to walk out of the office, but then he veers over to my sports editor's desk, and I remember this because I'm like, oh, shit. He's got a direct, clear path at him, and it's about to go down. And, you know, my boy is, you know, maybe 6'2", 6'3", big dude, and my sports editor is like, you know, 5'6", 5'7". It was a big mismatch, right? So anyway, he goes over to the desk and knocks all this shit off the desk, like books, folders, files, all this stuff. And he raises up like he's going to do something. It's like a scene from a daytime drama. So then, you know, me and one of my bosses hop up and intervene and are like, yo, chill. Like, get out. Like, go take a walk. Like, you cannot come back. So anyway, he walks out, never comes back. We hop up, tell him to get out. He doesn't come back. I don't think I ever talked to him again. It's crazy. So anyway, one of my bosses, who was actually a mentor, he's like, yo, that's how y'all do it at TCU, bro? And I was like, man, yeah, I guess so. I don't know, you know what I'm saying? I don't, but he does. So anyway, they didn't take any more job references from me. That, you know, they didn't hire anybody else I recommended to them, and I understand why. And the lesson of the story is, before you hook someone up with the job, you might want to find out why they got fired from their last one first. Because, you know, it might have some bearing on whether or not you really want to be a reference for them. Peace.
Joel of Missouri City, huh?
Yeah. Good friend of the show.
Yes, indeed. Oh, I'm going to f*** you up. No! I can just imagine Joel. I can really imagine him like, yo, you might want to go take a walk.
All right, this next one comes from Neil in Brooklyn.
Gotta tell you about the time I got my uncle working the job with me, with my company, over like Christmas holiday seasons. This is a couple of years back. And he came down from New York because he needed to make some extra cash for the holidays to get his kids some presents and stuff like that. He wasn't working. So I was like, sure, brought him down here and let him help me out with a couple of events. So I rented out party equipment, and it was for a party that was going on. It was a holiday party at a bowling alley right in Chinatown in D.C. And so had him come in and do the event with me, showed him how everything worked. Left him at the event so I can go handle some business someplace else. So after the event's over and everything, checking with him that night, he's like, everything went fine, no issues, no nothing. I get a call from the manager the next day saying that he needed to see me because he wanted to talk to me about some damage that had been done. So I go to my uncle, try to find out what happened. He's like, I don't remember anything happening. So we talk, I go in there and I'm talking to the manager, and he puts on the security video of my uncle pushing the machine out of the elevator and breaking the elevator while he's pushing it up. And then after, I was like, okay, well, apparently this happened, so I'm going to have to take care of the damage for that. And then after that, he cuts me the check for the event, but it was a little short. And I was like, hey, you know, just asked what was going on with the check. And he's like, well, your uncle left an open tab of $150 at the bar from the event. So that's why it's short. So not only did he drink up $150 at the bar with the folks there after the event, but he also broke the elevator on the way out. That's the last time my uncle worked for me.
Look, I contend, though, my man's got a different situation here, which is somebody in your family could have told you that uncle was not the one to get a job to. Like your homeboy, you get your homeboy a job or whatever. I can see how you might not know what the deal is. But I feel like somebody in your family told you not to get that uncle no job. Somebody did. So that's somebody's brother. And they were like, nah, I don't think you ought to do that. You're like, oh, come on, man. He always been good to me. Lesson learned.
That's a dereliction of duty right there.
Yeah, okay, come on. I would have fired you. Like, if it was just your partner, maybe, but your uncle, I'd have fired you too.
You got to shield your employer from your uncle in that case.
Yes, somebody knew that this was a bad idea. Why didn't they tell you?
Protect them from what they don't know.
Affirmative.
All right. This last one comes from Juju in Atlanta.
What's going on, Bo Money? So I got my homie a job. I worked at the studio, Patchwork here in Atlanta. I got this joker a job as an intern. Told the boss, yeah, he a reflection of me. You know what I mean? It's going to be another me, basically. I worked there for a couple of years. Got him the job, his first session, a high-profile artist. They gave him a couple $100 to go get food. This don't come back. He take the money. They have to look for him for hours and fire him on the spot. I end up having to pay the money out my pocket to give these folks, and the manager don't even mess with me. I got fired shortly after.
Damn! He just dipped out with the money? Lucky all he did was get fired. Ain't no telling who these recording artists were. Like, the range of potential outcomes of dipping out with somebody's money at the studio, that can go a lot of different directions, guys. A lot, and very, very few of them good for the dipper or anyone associated with him. Wow. Damn, sorry about that, Juju. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this a couple times a week. Gabe Bassane, Tarika Foster, and Christina Buswell handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Thank you to our sponsors. Also, thank you to CarMax. Thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Hannah Smothers of Vice. Check out her story on how this sedentary lifestyle is catching up to people at Vice.com. Thanks to Zoe Schiffer of The Verge. Check out her story on Instacart's decision to fire all the employees who tried to start a union. And thanks to Amanda Drain of the Houston Chronicle. Check out her story on the copyright issues that came up with diversified emojis. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.